All right, the Transportation Committee will come back to order. If there's anybody here to testify on Senate File 2644, we're going to hold that over until I understand that there was a little bit of controversy in the committee, but we'll hold that over till Thursday's meeting, and then we'll dispense of that. And Senator Dibble's not here yet, so why don't we start? I'm sorry, Senator Moy's not here. Senator Dibble, why don't we start with you? Oh, did she just come in? No, let's go with Senator Dibble. Senator Dibble, Senate File 3224.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate File 3224. Mr. Chair, I'll start with the A1 amendment, if I may. A1 amendment is Senator Rest's benefit. I wish she was here. She would be so proud. So.
I'll do it.
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment, what this bill does is it, MnDOT has the Bicycle Advisory Committee presently, and this transforms the Bicycle Advisory Committee into the Advisory Committee on Non-Motorized Transportation, so it expands its purview, if you will, to pedestrian and other sorts of non-motorized type transportation issues. And what the A1 amendment does is it just provides for some of those, just tightens up some of the language, provides for some of those items that that we try to conform to now as Senator Rest has enacted this regime of making sure that we're doing all these executive branch advisory committees in a consistent fashion.
All right. Senator Dibble has moved the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Mr. Rudin, you're here representing the department. Can you give us two sentences as to why this is a good bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs. And the State Bicycle Advisory Committee has actually been in existence since 1984. And this Advisory Committee on Non-Motorized Transportation will basically take the place of the State Bicycle Advisory Committee and slightly expand its role. The agencies that you see listed in the bill are currently involved with the Bicycle Advisory Committee, so these are not any new agencies that would become involved with this new committee. And there shouldn't be any additional cost to the state as a result of the legislation, since it is just replacing an existing committee.
All right, thank you. With that, Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 3224 be recommended to pass and re-referred to state and local government. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble, and maybe Mr. Rudin. How hands-on will this committee be as it relates to policy, perhaps, for example, in each of our cities? As our cities are trying to, I know that we're going through that struggle currently in Bloomington, actually. Shouldn't think of it as a struggle. We're, I think, working very hard. Our council is working very hard to create new bikeway opportunities, and yet. So I'm wondering, is that interaction going to occur at this level, or is this just sort of a broader policy overview leadership for staff that will then carry out those negotiations?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, I think those issues would continue to be addressed really at the city level. This committee only really meets a couple times a year. So unless they wanted to significantly expand the role that they've had historically, I think it would be really up to each individual city and the city engineers to, you know, discuss where particular bike paths would be located and so forth.
Senator Larson.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Rudin, I guess that goes to one of the challenges that we're facing is that MnDOT has a lot of rules that cities are abiding by as we try to make those plans, and some of them create restrictions. And I'm wondering if this in any way is going to change that. I'm not saying they're having a bad experience, but I'm just wondering how this will change that experience as they try to create additional opportunities, or will this not change it at all? It sounds like maybe it won't change it at all, but that's what I'm trying to get to.
Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, I don't believe it would change it because this, as I said, the Bicycle Advisory Committee has existed since 1984. So unless the members of this committee were convinced they needed to somehow change the role that they've had historically, I'm not sure you would see much change whatsoever.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Larson, part of my bill that's up later tonight has a study of complete streets, and that would deal with part of the issue that you're after in terms of design criteria for bicycle and pedestrian.
All right. Senator Day?
Mr. Chairman, I think he was just worried about maybe his skateboard. Somebody would take his skateboard away from him.
Senator Day, I made the mistake of thinking I could ride my son's skateboard a couple of years ago. I learned I'm not as young as I once
was.
Did
the same.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. On the Dibble motion to recommend the Senate File 3224 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on State and Local Government. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. And Senator Dibble, this is also a bill that if you want included in the omnibus bill, we'll put it in there. Okay. All right. Thank you. Senator Moi. Senator Moi, you weren't here when I made the announcement, but your Senate File 2644 will dispense with that Thursday at our
very good.
All right. So if we would take up 3027, that'd be great. Senator Wong.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to present to you Senate File 3027. It is a small bill and a simple bill. It basically asks that the Commissioner of Transportation post signs on approaches to trunk highway bridges. And those signs are very simple, red, orange, or yellow. A red sign for trunk highway bridges with average daily traffic of above 1,000 and sufficiency rating at or below 50. Orange signs for trunk highway bridges that do not meet criterion A but are classified as fracture critical or having a sufficiency rating at or below 80. And yellow signs for trunk highway bridges that do not meet criterion A or B but are scheduled for major repair and rehabilitation or replacement. Subdivision 2 merely requires that the commissioner replace these signs on bridge approaches when the bridge status changes from one category to another. And, Mr. Chair, I know the department opposes this bill. I've spoken to Ms. Parker, and I want, so they're going to they respectfully oppose it, and they're going to come and testify. But before we get to the department, I didn't realize this, but I actually have somebody who would like to testify on behalf of the bill. So,
Mr. Haney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Haney. I'm legislative and political director for the IBEW Minnesota State Council. The 13 local unions of the IBEW Minnesota State Council represent over 15,000 members throughout the state of Minnesota. Our members are, as you can imagine, electricians and utility workers. And in the course of doing their jobs, they're traveling to a work site and oftentimes driving a construction truck that's heavier than a pickup truck, a big truck, or in the case of a utility, utility workers driving some very, very heavy vehicles. Like I said, they're going out of their neighborhoods. They're not familiar with the roads and bridges that they're traveling across, and they don't know what the condition is of the bridges that they're traveling across. Some of the trucks, it might be a 12-ton truck, utility truck, pulling a 3,000-pound trailer with a 6,000-pound trencher on it. It's a lot of weight rattling across a bridge, and if the bridge isn't sufficient, that vehicle is likely going to do some more damage to the bridge, but it also is a risk to the people in the vehicle that are crossing it. I'm told that the line trucks that are for the high-voltage transmission lines are really quite a bit heavier than the other trucks, and the commercial driver's license, people are licensed to drive up to a 22.5-ton truck. So there's quite a bit of weight going across some of these bridges, and it is a public safety issue. It's also a worker safety issue with us, and we'd appreciate passing this bill and marking the bridges. After all, the bridges are owned and do belong to the public all the citizens of this state. So thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, you know, the bill is a simple bill, but it is really about public confidence, about public safety, public notice, and really public education. And so I hope that you'll give this bill some support. I know the department would like to comment. So,
thank you, Mr. Haney. Mr. Dorgan, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good evening. I'm Dan Dorgan. I'm the state bridge engineer with the Minnesota DOT. And we certainly appreciate the concern for bridge safety. We realize that concern is high, especially with the 35W tragedy. There are, regarding this bill, there are three points I'd like to speak to that cover our concerns. First of all, I think it's important to realize that we already do have a longstanding bridge posting system in the state. And that is one that motorists and truckers are familiar with. We currently have 24 trunk highway bridges that are posted with signs. On the local system, it's about 700 bridges are posted with load signs. And what these signs do is they warn truckers for the bridges that are restricted to loads that are less than legal. They also warn truckers for those bridges that cannot, where you cannot exceed legal limits, regardless of whatever overload permits you may have for your vehicle. So I think it's important to remember that those bridges are inspected. In the case of these structures, they're inspected annually. And as conditions change, those bridges are load rated and appropriate signing is done. So if the purpose of the legislation is to warn motorists of bridges that have deterioration that has somehow compromised their ability to carry load, that current load posting system is already in place. It's recognized and it's known throughout the country because other states have similar systems. So that, I think, is my first point. Secondly, I'd like to say the proposed legislation, well, it would affect about 170 trunk highway bridges that are either fracture critical or has sufficiencies below 80. It's not exactly clear what message we're trying to convey to the motorists with this signing, because if the message is thought to be one of safety, realize that whether a bridge is fracture critical or its sufficiency is less than 80 really doesn't tell you anything about the safety of the bridge. In fact, many of those structures can carry far more weight than other structures that wouldn't be in that condition. So I don't think we're really conveying the right message. Of the bridges affected, I mentioned 170, only about 35, 40 of those actually qualify for federal funds for replacement. So by federal criteria, they haven't even reached a condition where they'd qualify for federal funds to replace. So if that gives you some indication of the condition they're in. And lastly, I think it's important, how would the motorists react to these signs when they come down the road and see a red, yellow, or orange sign? Again, realize it's not a safety issue. So if a motorist somehow stops, tries to turn around, they're actually going to put, I think, themselves and other motorists more at risk than had they proceeded across the structure. So Chairman, I've kind of laid out our concerns, and we appreciate it. It's well-intentioned. I know in some of the previous testimony they mentioned some of the utility trucks. I realize our snowplow trucks run heavier than that, and they're going across these all the time, these same structures. So we appreciate the concerns for safety by the committee. If there's ever concerns, we certainly welcome the chance to talk to members, but we respectfully suggest in conclusion that our current load posting policy, I think, sufficiently handles the issue and that additional signs are really not needed. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Dorgan. Questions from the committee? Mr. Dorgan, I do have a question, and I realize that we do already have a posting system, but I didn't know that till I got elected and I was on the committee for about 5 years. Is there a way that we can use Senator Moy's idea to maybe heighten what we already do, making the public a little more aware of of what the current system that we have in play.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, regarding, and I know Senator Moi, your concern was that the public would know what structures these are. We actually, on our MnDOT website, we have posted the list of structurally deficient bridges. So these bridges are already available for people to view if they choose. Obviously, that doesn't help you if you're driving down the road. You would have to do that prior. But we've been very open with that information and published that in August and put it on our website. So it's certainly no secret which bridges they are. It's, again, just the necessity of signing. We do not see the benefit, and we think our load posting signs are a better indicator to the truckers and to those with a heavy load of what actions they should take.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Same one.
You know, Mr. Chair, on any given day, we all have constituents who crisscross the Mississippi River several times before they can get to their destination, whether that's going from this side of the river to the other side of the river or from home to work. Because of the geography of where we are, people crisscross bridges all the time. And, you know, the impetus for this bill really is with the full understanding of the work that MnDOT is trying to do in trying to be responsive. I think this bill speaks to your average everyday person who drives down the road. I don't know that it's necessarily going to make people deter them. It may deter somebody from crossing that bridge, but I think that what I'm trying to do here is to create some transparency. Not every individual knows that MnDOT has these bridges, and when they go on there, not every individual has access to the Internet. Not any individual is going to be able to navigate the Internet to know what it is. And so, you know, this is about transparency, and it's about giving our citizens confidence that we're being responsive. It is about giving them an opportunity to have notice and to be educated about the needs that we have. And I think if we do this and the public realizes how many of our bridges are fracture critical or how many of our bridges are in need of repair, I think that we would even get more public support and more public confidence that we are being responsive and that they will help us to garner the support that we need to get federal dollars as well as state dollars to make sure that we repair those bridges. Mm-hmm.
Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moi, it kind of reminds me of when you go out to the airport, you know, and they have these code systems for, and I think with your colors, it, people will kind of obviously relate those to different levels with those bridges. So that makes a lot of sense to me. But was that kind of your intent to?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, it was. I was looking for something that people could grasp and be familiar with. And so the first thing that came to mind was the terrorism, you know, warning levels, because I think that's very much been in the public eye. And I don't know, when I drive out to the airport, I see that the warning level is at yellow or the threat level is at orange. It doesn't deter me from not going, but it gives me notice allows me to take some caution or to just have it at the back of my mind. And so I did want to just hitch it to a system that was familiar.
Thank you. Senator Koch.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Mon, Senator Olsen, thank you for making that connection, because that's kind of how I see this. And frankly, those threat levels to me don't mean much anymore. I mean, it's orange, it's purple, it's yellow. What are we supposed to do with that? And so I'm just not sure. I understand what you're trying to do, and I understand what the threat levels are trying to do. But as a person, that it's become sort of, I don't even notice it anymore, quite frankly, going to the airport. It becomes just part of the landscape, and I'm not sure what my reaction is supposed to be. And as you said, with this, if it's red, do I apply the brakes and turn it around, or you know what? I'm just trying to figure out exactly the good, or you know exactly what we're going to achieve with this. I understand, you know, I hear you saying it's about public knowing, and I understand the trucking issue in particular, but if as a trucker, I would assume that they know about the load signs and they understand and watch for those, I would assume. If I had a trucker's license, I would try to familiarize myself with that. But so I'm just not sure what we're really going to accomplish with this. And I kind of do equate it with the threat levels, and I just don't know that those accomplish much for the everyday person. For law enforcement, very likely they do, but for the everyday person, what does it mean?
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe it does mean that somebody chooses not to cross a bridge that has a red sign on the approach because they don't feel that it's safe enough for them to do it. And perhaps that could send the message that we need to pay attention to our bridges.
Cute little baby, though.
So,
Mr. Dorgan.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you know, I think one thing to consider, and I look just take the fracture critical bridges, and I think those would have orange signs according to this legislation. Of the about approximately 70 fracture critical bridges on the MnDOT system, half of those, or over 35, were built in the late 70s into the 1980s. Some of these structures are on fairly new highways, like Highway 394. There are bridges that have a fracture critical pier cap in them because of the roadway alignments we needed. Those bridges were built with improved steels. We knew about fatigue by the time the years came to design those bridges. There's improved welding in those structures. They even had what we call a fracture control plan in the assembly of those structures. Those will be in service long after I'm gone. Those will be here 70 or 80 more years. So we'd be putting out a sign that would remain there for 70, 80 years, and I'd really question, what is that telling the motorists? And I think that's the majority of these bridges, the signs will have little meaning. And so I think we need to realize that because we're equating the subset of bridges somehow with not being safe, and that is just not the situation.
Mr. Dorgan, is there... And back to what I asked earlier, is there a way to improve our sign program so that the general public would have a better idea of what type of structure they were on? You know, I do, Senator Moy, draw pause with having red signs on bridges. And, you know, since the collapse of the I-35W bridge, I think everybody on the committee and most people in the public have gotten a better understanding of what kind of bridges we have and what rating systems mean and things like fracture critical. And, you know, I can picture in my head, you know, some of the bridges that are right now under paragraph A, you know, that would be red signs are actually bridges that are in fairly decent shape. And, you know, so I just, like I said, we've all come to understand a lot more about bridges, and I'm not exactly sure that, you know, a sufficiency rating at below 50, you know, fracture critical, things like that are appropriate for a red sign because, to me, red means stop. And I think that the bar needs to be set higher for that first tier is what I'm saying.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I understand some of the concerns about the various signs and wanted to have some meaning. I would love to continue to work with the department. I am very concerned that we have to make the information transparent and accessible to the average person, that not everybody has the ability to log on, go into a computer, and find out the conditions of our bridges. I'm a city that's surrounded by bridges in order for me to get anywhere from my side of town to the other side of town. And on a daily basis, I have a lot of constituents who are very nervous about crossing that Lafayette Bridge or the Robert Street Bridge or the Wabasha Street Bridge. So this bill, in part, was inspired by many of my constituents who have expressed to me, and for that matter, the Wakota Bridge, that, you know, they've got concerns because they just don't know that they ought to be crossing these bridges. And so maybe this was my simple-minded way of trying to create some transparency and an opportunity to communicate to the general public. But if the department is willing to entertain that intention and to work with me on that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to lay the bill over for further consideration and conversation with the department.
Okay, then Senator Moore, why don't we do this then? Why don't you and Mr. Dorgan and a few of his folks have some discussions on how we can improve on our current system? And if you come to some resolve, we'll include this in the omnibus bill.
I would appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And members, thank you for giving me a chance to present the bill.
Thank you, Senator Moore. Thanks, Mr. Dorgan. Thanks, Mr. Haney.
Next up is Senate File 3564. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a portion of the Senate File 3564 simply corrects a typographical error in the funding bill that we passed last week or the week before. Members, that's all it is. I see that, this might create the hair on somebody's neck to stand up, but once again, all this does is correct a typo. Mr. Chairman, and if people have questions, Ms. Berezovsky can. But that's if this is technical and.
Well, any questions from the committee? Seeing no questions, Senator Murphy moves Senate File. Where are we? 3564. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Say aye. Same sign.
Tax.
Full finance.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. This has to since it is a finance issue, it has to go back to Senator Cohen's committee. Okay. So it has to go to finance.
Senator Murphy is moving that it goes to finance. Mm-hmm. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Passed.
Mr. Chair, if this didn't make it all the way, it could be in the corrections bill, couldn't it?
It's into effect April 3rd.
All right, Senator Skoy. Mm-hmm. Senator Skoy, you have Senate File 3502, Implements of Animal Husbandry.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a couple of author's amendments. One is the A1 amendment, and the other is amendment that MnDOT had prepared that looks like this. So if I could get those two amendments passed out. And this is the first stop for the bill, so if I could offer those as author's amendments.
I'm sorry, Rod, could you repeat those again? Because I was talking with Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, and this is the A1 amendment, and then an amendment that looks like this that is prepared by MnDOT, and it was my fault for not getting it to Ms. Berezovsky in time. But
it's the A2 amendment.
The A2 amendment.
Mm-hmm. All right. This is your first stop. So on that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion does prevail. Those, the A1 and A2 have been adopted.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I'm here with Senate File 3502. This is a bill that deals with heavy wagons that farmers are towing with their crop and our bridges. We are putting bridge restrictions on those vehicles as they travel around. It seems like an appropriate thing to do. I'm here with Ms. Parker from MnDOT, and she will walk you through what some of the rationale behind this provision is.
Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. This is an issue that the department and the counties have been working on for 3 or 4 years now. We started drafting bills like this about 4 years ago. And the issue is that right now, under current state law, there are no restrictions on the amount of weight that a farm implement can carry across any bridge in Minnesota, even if that bridge is one of the bridges that cannot carry legal weights and has been posted with a lower weight. And that was probably an acceptable state policy in the days when farm implements were smaller and lighter and people maybe didn't fill them up to transport grain and other things or travel so far with them. But in recent years, it's become not really an acceptable idea anymore. And the second thing that prompted this is that the U.S. Department of Transportation has told us that we are not in compliance with federal law that requires states to limit the weight on bridges that cannot carry the legal weight. And if we do not do something to change state law, the federal government will conduct an audit this summer through their Office of Inspector General, and we will be required to post every bridge in the state, which would be a very expensive undertaking. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, we have been able to reach an agreement with the Department of Agriculture and with representatives of agricultural groups, and this bill has been developed after many meetings over the last year. And the I think two most important things in this bill are, one is on, I don't have the Senate version. I assume they're the same. Page 4, lines 16 through 18, which says that an implement of husbandry must comply with a sign that limits the maximum weight allowed on a bridge. And the farm groups have all agreed that they do not oppose that. And then, in addition, by the end of December of 2009, farm implements will be required to comply with the axle and gross weight requirements for crossing a bridge. And that requirement was deliberately set forward 2 years so that people would have an opportunity to talk about it, study about it, see how they're going to comply with it. And we will begin doing meetings with the ag industry and implement dealers. So basically, and then there are a number of other provisions in here that are pulled from all over different parts of Chapter 169, relating to farm implements, and they're all consolidated in one place. And I have Gene Halverson here from the MnDOT's Commercial Vehicle Office who could answer any questions about the details. But as far as we are aware, there is no opposition to this bill, and it's been thoroughly worked out with all of the affected parties.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Parker is right. I have touched base with the farm groups. They are okay with this bill. And it is really an issue on our farm. We have two grain carts that both will hold over 1,050 bushels, which is more than a semi-load. They're running on one axle. So if you were to be crossing bridges with those, it would be an issue. So I think mm-hmm. we're fine.
Well, let's do this. We can keep Major Halverson in his chair here. Is there anybody here that's opposed to this bill? I don't see anybody. And any questions from the committee? Seeing Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, I was in the Vets Committee waiting to testify one day, and there was talk of these big LP tanks. They were going to be seed tanks or the nurse tanks, I think. They were really going to be pretty big. Would they fall under this category?
Senator Skoy.
Senator Olsen, I also was in that. Those were the 5,000-gallon anhydrous ammonia tanks, and if they were full, they very likely would fall into this category.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, if you remember, those tanks are filled in the field, and they don't travel around full of anhydrous.
All right, great. Senator Skoy moves that Senate File 3502, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. Senator Skoy will also put this in the omnibus bill as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
On that motion, further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Parker. Next up, we have Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, Senate File 3419 is a bill that would repeal the provisions in law that permit certain vehicles to display tax-exempt license plates without vehicle identification requirements and adds instead language to permit those vehicles to be licensed with unmarked regular passenger class license plates. And it would require all vehicles with tax-exempt license plates to comply with the law's current vehicle marking requirements in Section 168. Mr. Chair, the bill is necessary in addition, I should also note that the proposal, the second part of the bill, would require that any license plate be mounted on a vehicle in an upright manner and if displayed on a motorcycle at the rearmost point of the motorcycle. Now, Mr. Chair, these provisions are intended to reduce confusion as it relates to law enforcement as they encounter these vehicles. There's certain reasons why we have state vehicles that should remain where some privacy should remain in cases of state hospitals, child and vulnerable adult social service agencies, and the like. And so this bill clears up that confusion so that we can provide for vehicles that aren't marked for that purpose, but clearing up the confusion with law enforcement. Mr. Chair, Mr. Larry Olilla is here from the department if there are questions.
Mr. Olilla, does this change anything for the existing? I understand that we're opening up another class, but it doesn't change what's happening right now. I mean,
Mr. Chair, members, this came to our attention as a result of some law enforcement groups that said that they had trouble understanding why there were some vehicles traveling with tax-exempt license plates and there were no markings on the side of the vehicle. Okay. So what this does is it allows those entities, the state hospitals and the social service agencies that are allowed to transport these vulnerable adults or individuals that have some disabilities, they can still qualify for the tax-exempt rate, but they'll display regular passenger license plates rather than the tax-exempt license plates.
I got it. Is there anybody that wants to speak in opposition to the bill? Further comment from the committee? Looks Senator Larson moves that Senate File 3419 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. Senator Larson will also include this in the omnibus bill as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ola. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Now it's the Senator Olsen hour. Senator Olsen, looks like you've got about the next 12 bills up here. So
he said that would be 10 minutes. Mr.
one motion will take care of all of them.
Okay.
It's Olsen's 10 minutes.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members, I'm pleased to be before you tonight, albeit with four different bills, but I think they're pretty substantial bills, but they aren't very long. So I do have an author's amendment for Senate File 2988, which I would like to introduce. It's the A3 amendment.
All right. Senator Olsen, why don't you tell us what the A3 does while it's being passed out?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we've been working through this bill, we found that there's language that kind of didn't do what I wanted it to do. It addresses non-scheduled or non-regular transportation, and we had that in there And the problem with that was, like in a school district, if a principal was going to take a sick child home, we just forbid for this language did not allow that to happen. So we want to strike that language in a couple of different spots so that it gives school districts some chance for some flexibility to transfer their students.
This is the original.
Mr. Chair, I think we might have a different version of the bill.
That's exactly what was going on here, Senator Olsen. What is in the packet is as introduced, and then there were some changes that were made in the first committee, and they're not on that text.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. Mm-hmm.
Senator Olsen, why don't we do this? And I hate to, well, it looks like Mr. Urquhart is going to be here for the rest of the time anyway. So why don't we set this one aside and move to 3535, and we'll get the appropriate copies passed out of that first bill.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. Senate file 3535, I think will be a very positive step in our monitoring of our school buses and our school bus drivers. This bill is coming about from a variety of different sources, including the legislative auditor's report, that not only the Type 3 vehicles, but that the inspections of our school buses need to be tightened up, especially on the recording and the technology end, and also that unfortunately, it seems like we only have 12 inspectors, and by law, they are required to physically inspect the buses every year. So it doesn't leave really enough staff to look at drivers' records and get into some of those other details that might indicate that somebody might maybe shouldn't be driving a bus. So what we've done is establish an Office of Pupil Transportation Safety, which by state law, there needs to be somebody who is the director of pupil transportation safety, and Captain Urquhart, in one of his many roles, serves in that position. But this bill is essentially establishing this new office where we have, we say, a minimum of 4 state troopers and a minimum of 15 inspectors to make sure that all the physical inspections are done, but also more staff that can actually start looking at some of the driver's records. And I'd like to turn it over to Captain Urquhart at this time.
Captain Urquhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, thank you for allowing me to appear before the committee. Just briefly, the State Patrol on an annual basis inspects about 14,000 school buses. And we do this through a scheduled process. So, for instance, if a school district we visit today and inspect all their buses, within about 12 months of today, we'll be returning to inspect all those buses. Presently, we have 12 inspectors that are dedicated to inspecting all those vehicles. Based on time availability, we do try to conduct unannounced inspections on school buses and or the drivers. But when we inspect make these annual inspections, the drivers are not present. So basically, we're looking at the vehicle itself to ensure it's in safe operating conditions. And if you look at the most of the contributing factors to crashes involving school buses, the crashes are not directly linked to the vehicle problems. It's more often the driver of another vehicle. Mm-hmm. So we need to do some more of these duties on a regular basis. And I think the legislative auditor has brought that out in their report. And in order for us to meet some of those requirements, we really need to have some additional staffing committed to that. Mm-hmm.
Senator Olsen, do we have a number to put in on line 25 on page 2?
Mr. Chair, Captain Urquhart had given me some initial numbers, but they included like squad cars and everything, so I don't think it
be a fair number for ongoing cost of four more troopers and three more inspectors, because there was some initial costs. It was approximately $2 million for the additional staff. So at this point, I don't think that's a good number to put in there.
Okay. this Senator Olsen, this bill needs to go to finance, I believe, next, and you're going to need to have a number to put in there so that we can keep the books balanced. Granted, there's a little more money in the trunk highway fund today than there was yesterday, but still have to balance the books.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I know we're asking for four troopers, so I'm also hoping that that might be possible because of the transportation bill passing. And then if I might point out on line 1.23, addressing some of the concerns by the legislative auditor's office was designing a better record-keeping system that would track not only the inspections but some of the drivers' files and out-of-service data and all that kind of stuff. Now, Captain Urquhart says that they are getting a new system, and hopefully that will be able to address some of these concerns.
Senator Dibble.
Well, thanks. That was one of my questions. This is a great bill. It's very responsive to a lot of the findings and recommendations of the legislative auditor, and I think it'll go a long ways towards addressing the concerns that we all found out about there. So thank you, Senator Olsen. I've been told, but I've forgotten this record-keeping system, this new technology. Is that already being paid for somehow? Is there a price tag to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, presently we use a product that was developed by the USDOT, and we also use that product not only to inspect our school buses, but we use it for our roadside inspections on other buses and commercial vehicles. We're being told that the USDOT is developing an additional product that is specifically designed for jurisdictionally mandated inspections, which is what the school bus program is. We have not seen the version yet. We're supposed to get a snap look at this version on the week of the 24th of March. And so I'm kind of curious to see if it's going to meet some of our needs or not. If it does not meet our needs, then we have to look at something that's going to be specifically designed for us to capture the things that I think the legislative auditor identified.
So we don't have a price tag. And I was wondering if there obviously is not a fiscal note, but when there is one, will that estimate be calculated into the fiscal note? That
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, on I think it's like 219 and 220. There's an annual report, and one of that's including adequacy of funding, staffing levels, and available technology to carry out the requirements of Section 1. So if, in fact, approximately not quite a year from now, if the new system does not work, then the report will probably be looking at a funding stream for a better system.
And one final follow-up. I was just wondering if a different source of resources might be, do we register these buses? Is there, is there a registration fee that might help pay for the inspections regimen? We have the private providers that are charging our school districts more than what it would cost otherwise. They're obviously making a lot of money. They're not paying their drivers anything, and our school districts are paying more than they would if they had provided these services in-house. And so, do the privates have any fees that they pay that might be a source that the state patrol can go to for some resources to pay for this office and the full program?
Captain?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, at this point in time, we collect no fees. Even though we provide, the basic thing we provide is the inspection and the decal that goes on the bus. So as part of the program, we pay for those decals as the agency to be, every year, to be put on the vehicles. And we don't collect any fees from either the school districts or the private contractors. I do remember this question coming up, I think, at Senator Olsen's school bus safety committee hearing to the industry, and I don't recall what the response was to that.
Well, I'm wondering if it's possible in the future to think about. I mean, don't buses have a registration fee of some sort? Like we have license tab fees? I mean, can we build in?
Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, the school district-owned buses primarily have tax-exempt plates on or school bus plates on them. If they're running with tax-exempt, then they're not going to be paying those fees. And the private contractors, of course, use their buses for charter, so they are paying registration fees on their buses with a BY plate, mm-hmm. whatever those fees are.
Okay. So, Senator Olson, that might be a place we can go for.
Duly noted.
If Senator Murphy has some heartburn about how much is going to fall out of the Trunk Highway Fund.
Well, if they're buying troopers with it, that's okay. Further questions for Senator Olson? Is there anybody here that wants to testify either in support or opposition of this bill? Seeing none, Senator Olson moves that Senate File 3535 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. And Senator Olson, you and Captain Rickard are basically joined at the hip here with a lot of different school bus initiatives. And if we get all the blanks filled in on the school bus bills, we'll roll those into the omnibus bill as well.
Mr. Chair, it's been a pleasure to work with the captain also. He probably is not saying that about me, but for me it's been.
Yeah, you should have heard what he said about you. No, it was all good. It was all good. On the Olson motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you. Let's revert back to 2988.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on line, the A3 amendment at line, or page 1, line 13, will strike the language that says non-scheduled or non-regular transportation. And then also down at line 24. It also strikes for non-scheduled or non-regular transportation. And, Mr. Chair, members, that was the language that would have exempted, like, the school nurse from taking a sick child home. So we felt that was pretty important to strike that language.
Understandable.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
But, Senator Olson, does this open up using Type 3 buses for getting kids back and forth to school, at the beginning and the end of the day?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, when we strike non-scheduled or non-regular, that's those special trips. And, we wanted to address that specifically, but when we're talking about regular transportation, we're not we're exempting school district employees who do not, their main job is not transporting students. For instance, the debate coach or some of those smaller teams like the math league team or something like that. We're exempting those type of school district employees. But anyone whose regular job is transporting students, that this bill is directed to those.
Exemption is right.
Okay.
Exemption for all those folks. Mm-hmm. The superintendent, those kind.
Senator Olson has offered up the A3 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Olson, do you know of anybody, any opposition to the bill?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't. There's, I guess I want to make a point very dramatically clear, if I may, that what's driving this bill really started when Amanda Berglund was killed in a Type 3 vehicle accident, and the driver was found to have marijuana in his system and all of these things. And so we've really tightened up the we're talking about pre-employment drug and alcohol, random drug and alcohol, physicals, 2-year physicals. And then Captain Urquhart, as he points out, that
A driver of a Type 3 vehicle can have up to the legal limit of alcohol in their system. So that's the main components of the bill is we're taking that out of there, zero tolerance for alcohol. And then we're moving some of the rules that a Type A driver, a Type A school bus driver, would have to operate their bus under over to the Type 3s. So as far as opposition, I have heard some groups that would prefer a Type A to have an endorsement, but I don't think that's for this discussion with the Type 3s. And some of the bus organizations feel it's a good bill, but I might have gone a little far on, like, requiring seatbelt instruction on some of the students. But I think we have to remember that in these Type 3s, some of the students that are being transported may be mentally or physically handicapped students, and they may not understand the seatbelt procedure. So I felt it was proper to leave seatbelt instruction in there. Although it seems very simple, I think there's a number of students that may not understand the seatbelt operation.
Okay. Further discussion, Senator Dibble.
Just thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be, as you can probably tell, I've followed this issue for a little while myself. So just to be clear, I'm most curious, just to understand the overview of the bill. The bill requires that operators of Type 3 vehicles, have some, don't have to have a full-scale school bus endorsement.
Correct.
But we want them to receive some level of training. And make sure that they're, they have the same level of scrutiny and hold them to similar standards as we would a bus driver. In the case of the coaches, it sounds like a lot is similar, except we don't duplicate what we already ask of teachers and coaches in terms of background checks and drug and alcohol, because they're already subject to that in their regular job. Is that a
Mr. Chair, summary? Senator Dibble, that's very correct. Plus, there's a number of bills working through the legislature right now that even require background checks on like volunteer coaches.
Right,
So that end, I think, is being really tightened up also.
Okay.
Senator Dahl.
Kind of give me an idea what that pertains to and why the exceptions
to the EFGA. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl. I got to be careful not to say those letters too fast because it might come out wrong. Let's see. Yeah, we felt that we really were targeting this bill to people that are full-time driving a Type 3 bus. A lot of the Type 3 buses are operated by contract carriers, not necessarily a school district. They are primarily hauling special ed students around, and a lot of school districts contract that out. And so we're addressing the people that drive kids as their regular job, as the main part of their job. And we felt that we're exempting, like I mentioned earlier, the coaches, school district employees whose job is not primarily driving students. So that we're thinking like those coaches of the small sports. And we got a lot of feedback from like rural school districts where they said, if we had to send a full bus for the debate team or the math league team, we might not be able to participate in that sport. So the anticipation is that it's probably a coach driving, and they work with students as their job. And so a lot of those exemptions are just kind of training that as a teacher or somebody who works in a school district, that would be a normal part of their job, the E, C, F, G, and K.
And, Mr. Chair, the Senator will see the things like alcohol and things like those kind of policies are probably already part of the drug or the school policy anyway, I would assume, if they're a coach or someone that's going to be dealing with children. So that's why you're looking for the exemption there?
That's correct.
And then there's the last one was on K. Was an operator who sustains a conviction while employed shall report the conviction to the employer within 10 days. That's
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, that is the most interesting number K you'll ever come across, because in my office I had the attorney that was representing the Berglund family and the attorney that was representing Twin City Transportation that was the bus that she was killed in. And, you know, sitting there with those two attorneys trying to figure out how we can prevent this from happening again, it was kind of an amazing moment for me. But the attorney from Twin City Transportation said, we need a tool, because this is what would happen. He said that if we were going to fire somebody because they had alcohol in their system or drugs, they claim American Disabilities Act, and then it automatically changes into a medical situation. So they couldn't discharge that person is what we were told. But by requiring that, because honestly, if you get a DWI, you think you're going to turn it into your boss. I mean, you're fired right there. So what he said, if we had this language that you had to report a DWI or another infraction like that, that gives them grounds to dismiss that person if, in fact, you know, they get notice that that their driver had received a DWI. So they were requesting that as a tool so that, because he said, we want to fire those people just as much as anybody else, but in many cases we can't, because they will claim that it's a medical problem and they have to address it.
Thanks.
That was a long answer, but.
Mm-hmm. Senator Dibble.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand the reason for paragraph K, but why did we exempt the teachers and coaches from paragraph K? That's the part I didn't quite connect
well,
to.
Senator Dibble, it's my understanding that most of those people are already under contract to report that regardless.
Okay.
I think that's right. Part of the terms of their employment.
Thank you.
Mr.
I know
Chair,
it is most places I've worked at, they want to know.
Great.
Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, I've gotten to know this bill quite well. I'm very passionate about it. I think it's a nice fix for what turned out to be quite a loophole. When the captain said that you can operate these vehicles with the legal limit of alcohol in your system, I mean, it kind of floored me. And so I think we've made some great strides to clean up our student transportation in these Type 3 vehicles.
All right, Senator Olsen, there is rulemaking in this bill, so you need to go to state and local government with this bill. So,
Mr. Chair, we've already been there.
Oh, you've already been there.
Yeah.
Oh, well, then we'll make this easy then. Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 2988 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. Senator Olsen will also include this in the omnibus bill as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On that motion, all in favor. First, is there anybody that wants to speak either for or against the bill? Seeing none on the motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, motion does prevail. Thank you. Senator Olsen, Senate File 3561.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 3561 is a kind of a technical bill. The biggest thing that we're doing here is on the Type A buses, we're changing the weight on them from 10,000 pounds to 14,500 pounds. Now, we're not changing the capacity of number of students that can be transferred or anything like that. It's as time has gone on, these buses are kind of evolving physically to more diesel engines, which are heavier bodies, and so it's just to allow, this comes in line too with the national, I don't know if I'll get the acronym right, but there's a National School Bus Association that kind of sets the standards for safety for school buses, and this brings these buses back in line with the rest of the nation, I believe, because it's a national recommendation. And then we are also talking about the multifunction school bus, which I think maybe one of my personal goals is to eventually get students out of these Type 3 vehicles and into the multifunction bus, which is more of the Type A chassis. So a multifunction bus would be a heavier-bodied bus, mm-hmm. but it it would not have the eight ways, and it wouldn't have to be painted orange and black. But and it could not be used for student picking up students, but it could be used point-to-point transportation. Mm-hmm. So those are probably the two main changes in the bill, unless Captain Urquhart would like to address something.
Captain?
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is making these recommendations through the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, and Senator Dolcine's right. What they're really trying to do here is get children into better designed vehicles when they're being transported from point to point. This is not a vehicle that's going to be used on a home-to-school or school-to-home on a route, mm-hmm. so it won't have those eight-way light systems or control arm to control traffic. And really, this all started, this whole discussion federally started because of the number of incidents involving these kinds of passenger vans, and they're subject to rollover, mm-hmm. and they really don't protect the children as well as this newer design vehicle. Mm-hmm. So as far as the design of vehicle, it's a better thing for the kids.
All right. Questions from the committee? Senator Dibble.
A little out of my depth here, but I do know that some concern has been expressed. Do you have the Senator Olson? Do you have the profiles or what the A, B, C, D
yes.
look like?
I could draw a picture. is the legislative auditor? I think there might be a handout that might have that picture in your brochure. But in any case, a type A is a van cab in a bus body. So it will have one door that's a van door, and the other door will be a swing arm type door like a regular school bus. So it the safety advantage that the captain was addressing is that literally where the students are riding, it's a bus body. So you've got, and believe me, I've worked on a number of these buses where they're very structurally a sound, mm-hmm. solid, a lot of steel surrounding those students. So, and they also go to, while I mentioned earlier the heavier weights, they're a much heavier construction than any Type 3 vehicle. So
I think, Mr. Chair, the concern is, I think the goal is desirable on one side that, we want to get kids into these better vehicles, but the licensing standards for the Type A is different than the Type D, and I think that's the full-fledged Type D endorsement is a higher standard, a higher threshold, and these are now going to be considered Type A, and they're a substantially heavier vehicle being driven by someone who doesn't meet the same licensing standards. I think that was the concern articulated by the school bus representatives.
Captain,
if I'm remembering,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble. If the Type A school bus is used on a home-to-school or school-to-home route, they are required to possess the school bus endorsement and that commercial driver's license. If the Type A bus is used on a point-to-point as an activities bus, then it releases them from the endorsement as long as they meet all the other safety qualifications that's listed under the driver's license statute. What these vehicles would do would provide even a much better vehicle than the Type A is because of the weight classification and the construction. Mm-hmm. And it can only be used on point-to-point and not on a route. So the A is really a school bus, but it has served us as a multifunction until this design was devised and then recommended by our federal colleagues.
Mm-hmm. So what's the essential difference, though, point-to-point versus, school-to-home? Why don't we want folks to have the same standard of training and endorsement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, that law was changed a number of years ago, and it wasn't a department issue. This came from the industry itself as a flexibility need. And, it was early on in my career as the pupil transportation safety director, so I had a little bit of input on it, but it was something that the school folks were adamant about so they could, better utilize their bus fleets and still remain safe. And this discussion has gone on for a number of years back and forth about whether or not those endorsements should be required on all those buses.
Well, I think what happens, Mr. Chair, is, they make use of existing staff. You know, it's kind of like our Type 3 discussion that we just had. Mm-hmm. And while the Type 3s are, you know, dramatically different because they're much smaller, and I'm comfortable with where Senator Olsen went because he was beefing up the standards, frankly, for the Type 3, which was great. Now it seems like, you know, we're making a more substantial vehicle, but, you know, folks without the full-fledged endorsement are driving them. And I don't make a distinction school to home or point to point. You're transporting kids. Mm-hmm. There's not you're not stopping in as many places, but you're still transporting a bunch of kids mm-hmm. in what's now going to be a much more substantial vehicle. So on one side, I think you're moving in the right direction. On the other side, I think you're moving in slightly the wrong direction, Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, if I could address some of Senator Dibble's concerns. When you're going from point to point, you know, you're not operating the eight ways or the crossing gate or the student door, and you're not stopping in traffic, you know, so that's primarily the main difference between, you know, they're very similar to like a U-Haul type size vehicle, and you know, whether or not that should have a special endorsement, I think is a fair question. But I think at this point of the game, we're just trying to, because of course we're not following this with any money. So I think school districts are going to be, you know, they're not going to jump into these buses right away. I think we're trying to give them an opportunity to maybe switch their fleets as they do some replacements, because the districts that I have talked to would much rather us follow this with some money to do this, but because they are more expensive. But I think we're looking at language to allow school districts to kind of start moving towards these multifunctionals at this point.
Senator Dahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was just following in line with what Senator Dibble was saying, is that, you know, it, to me it doesn't matter point to point or, you know, from the home to the school, that it's kids being driven on the road, and maybe there's a few less activities, but primarily the function is to get them from point A to point B safely. And operator error is, you know, way more important than, you know, the construction of that vehicle. And, you know, if they're going to be driving around a heavier vehicle now, it means that they should probably have able to qualify to drive those particular vehicles. So that's my concern, I guess, is that we're addressing that. And I don't know if that's something that you're going to address in a follow-up bill or how you would do that, but my concern is that we're making sure that these drivers are qualified for whatever equipment that they're using.
Well, the issue about, you know, whether or not the wrestling coach can drive the vehicle or not is not going to be settled here. I mean, that's going to be an issue that's going to be talked about for quite a long time. And I can see that, you know, our good friend is sitting in the front row there, and he's not gonna but you know, that is something that we need to keep in the back of our minds. But the thing to remember in that regard is we've piled on the school districts a lot as far as additional costs, and you know, most people know the wrestling coach or the swim coach, and they're all competent people. And you know, if that's what it takes to save the school district a little bit of money and, you know, still keep our kids safe, then I'm comfortable with that. You know, those are decisions that are best left for principals and probably not us legislators. So, Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just thought thanks for whoever brought these in. These are great. It's on page 16 if folks want to take a look at what we're talking about here. If I'm not mistaken, what would happen now is what's currently under the B category would now be considered A under, or something similar or similar size. I don't know if that's, you know, with the doors and all that, that's precisely what.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, the B is kind of a hodgepodge. It's kind of a chassis onto itself. More of a custom-built bus. The A is the one that has more of a van front on it, and then the bus body. So B is just kind of an orphan category, I think. You don't see many Bs around, but then the C is your typical, you know, bus with a hood on it, and then the D's are the big pushers with the engine in the rear, and primarily engine in the rear, but the door is in front of the front axle. So, so Senator Dibble, I don't think the B, I think that's still a different category, just because of the structural.
I'm just saying for, but it'll be like the size of a B. The A will now be kind of up in that size.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I don't believe so. I think primarily why we're talking about going from a weight of 10,000 to 14,000 is because of heavier components within the bus. Actually a lot of them have been running diesels for a while, but a diesel engine is heavier than a gas engine and, probably a bigger fuel tank and more structural steel around the fuel tank for support. And then probably it's going with heavier brakes and those kinds of things. So it's just allowing the chassis and the weight of the vehicle is increased, not the number of students inside. That is, the body itself is staying the same.
Mm-hmm. And just to your point, Mr. Chair, about how much we heap on school districts and how expensive school transportation is, I agree completely with you, and we were having a little discussion about rural versus city. We pay way more than we should, I think, in student transportation for different reasons than rural districts face. I think the auditor's report shows that Senator Olsen's reform in that first bill is going to help a lot, and there's a lot more that we need to do because school districts don't quite know what their responsibilities are, how to manage the function most effectively, most efficiently. We got this huge problem with the privates charging way more than necessarily they should be. It's easy to demonstrate that those who are in-house are paying. Everyone's out of whack with their revenue and expenditures. Those who are using the privates are way more out of whack, and so we have a lot of work to do in this area.
Just clarify that.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsen.
On all things technical, I turn to the captain, and he's got probably a pretty good response for this.
Captain.
This may help address, Mr. Chairman, this may help address Senator Dibble's concern. Once that passenger capacity gets to 16, including the driver, it triggers the CDL requirement by federal regulation. So that bus, based on capacity, can only get so large, and then the CDL is required. And I think these buses, it's really due to the design factors that Senator Olsen has talked about that has brought the weight classification up for the bus. And it does lend credibility in a crash, because if you're a heavier vehicle in a crash, you're going to do a lot better than you are if you're a lighter vehicle and protect your occupants.
I'm getting more comfortable.
All right. Well, with that, Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 3561 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. Is there anybody that wants to speak either for or against this bill? Seeing none. On Senator Olsen's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, members. But
we have 3383. You're on a roll.
I'm on a roll. Captain Urquhart is released.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
but he just
Captain.
Took my bill. Let's see.
Maybe he doesn't like this one.
This is a pretty simple okay. bill, and it's just kind of cleaning up language. A lot of these days, if you're running, like if you're a business, like a landscape business or something, and you have a pickup truck and a trailer and your gross weight is over 10,000 pounds, you need to have DOT numbers. Thank you. And so this kind of addresses that. It's really just cleaning up a lot of language, but luckily I have Larry Ola from Department of Public Safety, and he'll talk about the technical stuff on this one.
Mr. Ola.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Larry Ola with Department of Public Safety. What this bill does is address a situation. A few years ago, there was a requirement put into the statute that when someone renews registration on a vehicle that's 10,000 pounds or more, they're required to supply a DOT number. The intent, we believe, was not right, to include individuals who had vehicles that were being used for private purposes, for instance, with a recreational vehicle. Also was not intended to cover governmental vehicles. However, this bill also then addresses the buses, which we believe should have been covered under the original bill. So it's just relieving those individuals, private individuals that have vehicles, and governmental agencies from the DOT requirements.
Thank you. Is there anybody who wants to testify either in support or opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Olsen has moved that Senate File 3383 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. Senator Olsen, as with the rest of your bills, this is also a candidate for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Mr. Ola.
Mr. Chair, members, I think we did a real good work today towards moving towards safer student transportation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Olsen. And committee member, Senator Olsen's been working on school bus safety all fall and into the session here, and he's done a great job. I just wish we could have had four bills be one. That's just a hint for next time. All right.
Gotcha.
Senator Dahl, 2938.
All right. Since Senator Olsen took up the whole evening here, we'll try to make this one quick. Mr. Chair, members, the Senate File 2938 is clarifying some language regarding wheelage tax as it relates to motorized scooters, electric bikes, or motorized bicycles, and the like, and just removing that, exempting them from wheelage tax. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty straightforward.
Yep.
Last year it was in the last year's transportation bill that was vetoed.
Yes, it was.
The provision, though, since that was, it wasn't enacted in the law then, and the exemption was simply not included in this year's funding package because there was no wheelage tax provision in the bill, mm-hmm. I believe. So we wanted to get that cleared up, and so that's the intent behind Senate File 2938.
All right. One time for the record, Senator Dahl, this in no way, shape, or form imposes a wheelage tax on anyone. All it does is remove the wheelage tax from those mopeds and things like that.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
All right, great. Is there anybody here that wants to testify either for or against the bill? Senator Skoy.
Does Senator Dahl want a helmet provision?
Oh, is he? I think that's what he said. There was an amendment for a helmet provision.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you want to put that provision on this bill? Oh, I think I'll get some opposition from folks
in
the district.
It would definitely be, seeing no further discussion, Senator Dahl moves Senate File 2938 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Senate floor, or to taxes, I'm sorry. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you. Senator Jungbauer. It's now the hour of Jungbauer. So, Senator Jungbauer, we have Senate File 3545. This is a piece of work that Senator Jungbauer has been working on now for quite some time. It's got a lot of different ideas in it. And Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members and everybody that's here to testify against the bill can stay in their seats until I explain the delete all author's amendment.
Great. Senator Jungbauer, you brought a bill that has controversy to our committee.
Oh, never, Senator Murphy. I would never think of controversy. But I always also wanted people to know that I was looking at the clock and saying, I don't want to stay around here all night, so we got our last-minute delete all. Bonnie was good enough to put it all together really quickly so we could end the controversy. And actually, there still may be some, so I'll just start out by saying, the bill really seeks to update statute. We got some issues in statute that haven't been clarified in years, and we're going to try to take care of them. The secondary thing is we're trying to tighten some loopholes within that statute, and quite honestly, people in the industry know we've got some bad players out there. And in terms of vehicles that don't have license plates that were exempted under special mobile equipment, we've got some bad players that are running untaxed off-road fuel, and they're driving alongside of us on the highway every day, and we're trying to figure out how do we get those bad players to come up on an even playing field? So having said that, there's going to be a few little things that we're going to have to try to work on in terms of probably little clarifying lines or something.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not wanting to stay here all night, it will be my intention after we look through the bill, members, to say we want to include it for possible inclusion or lay it over for possible inclusion in the policy bill. Mm-hmm. And in the next couple of days before we put that policy bill together, the stakeholders have all agreed to come in and offer some little clarifying snippets so that we can all agree that we're going to stop the bad players, work on moving the policy and updating the statute. And take care of that. So there might be some little clarifying stuff, but I think we're pretty darn close, Mr. Chair and members. So at this time, I'll offer the A3 amendment.
On the A3 delete all amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion does prevail.
All right. So has everybody got the amendment now?
Just so everybody knows, that was just a procedural motion. We did not adopt the bill. All we did was adopt the delete all language.
Author's amendment.
The author's amendment. So we're working in front of the copy that Senator Jungbauer wants us to work on.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to start at line 1.5. And what this looks at is, especially in my district, members, I don't know how your highways are, but or I shouldn't even say in my district, but it's moving up towards my district. Every time MnDOT fixes an intersection on Highway 65, the dangerous ones move north closer to my house. But every year the insurance industry, and I can't remember which specific snippet, comes out with a crash cost indicator, members, which tells us how much bodily damage, property damage are in certain intersections, how many literally bodies we're carrying away. And I always get calls from constituents that drive that highway every day saying, well, how come this intersection rates number one worst in the state of Minnesota according to the insurance industry and MnDOT rates at number 8 or 9? So what we're asking MnDOT to do is when they're setting their priorities and looking at the projects, that they factor this in somehow and look at what the insurance industry is saying. So if they're saying an intersection is number one and on their rating system it's number 9, somehow they're going to factor that in and say, well, maybe we ought to take a closer look. I don't know. We want to work with MnDOT to come up with some clarifying language on how they would factor that in. But I think it's important when our constituents hear an insurance rating and they hear MnDOT's priority list. So that's what that does.
And Senator Jungbauer, Mr. Arsenault and was over there shaking his head. They're going to work with you here on that portion.
So, again, we didn't want to offend MnDOT to the point where they did want us to stay all night and talk about this. So,
well,
so
Ms. Parker would. maybe she wouldn't. So.
I'm sure she would, and she'd be uplifting and edifying, as Ms. Parker always is, in trying to understand the legislative mind, which is very confusing at times, especially during the first deadline. All right, members, we'll move to line 1.11. This section I affectionately call the Y-plate section, something that I've been looking at for a number of years. And originally, a Y-plate on a vehicle was designed as a commercial license plate, and most of the discussion, if you look way back when, was around cube vans and coming up with some more of an entry-level commercial license plate. Well, because of the way vehicles are rated, some passenger vehicles have these Y plates. And by the way, members, a Y plate typically costs $120 as opposed to the cheapest standard vehicle plate, I believe, is about $320, so roughly $200 difference. And that was assuming a $25,000 vehicle. And when you're up into that GVWR rating, it's probably more than that today in terms of dollars and cents. On a $40,000 vehicle, as of last year, the statistic was about a $511 license plate. So, again, some people are buying a Y plate to be cheaper when, in fact, it's designed to be a commercial, and commercial vehicles are under different inspections, different other things. And how I really got the notice on that was every year I'll get our commercial enforcement people, some of who we may have be able to tell us some things, set up this nice little, let's see, our contractors call it a sting operation in Burns Township in the middle of my district every year, and they do it 2, 3, 4 times. And I'll always get this call from somebody that says, Senator, I got an inspection on my vehicle. I have a personal vehicle. Why am I getting inspected? And my first question to them is, are you running a Y plate? They say, yeah. Well, that's why you're getting inspected. That's supposed to be a commercial plate. And people don't like that. So really what this section does from line 1.11 to 1.22 is clarify the Y plate as being a commercial plate, mm-hmm. everything else as being a standard plate, mm-hmm. And some of the language we have in statute today talks about like a one-ton pickup, and really it all gets back to gross vehicle weight ratings. So we're trying to clarify the gross vehicle weight rating and what qualifies for the Y plates and what would be exempt in terms of passenger. DVS tells us their computer system is not set up today to characterize it under this GVWR rating, so they may put in something that says it will not be implemented until their new computer program will accept this change, mm-hmm. and that's fine. We just want to make sure that when we're clarifying statute that we don't have them come up with a whole new program and they don't put any of this new stuff in. So we're going to tell them up front some of the things we might want in there.
All right. In that subdivision or in that section there, Senator Jungbauer, we've got two insertions that need to be made.
Okay.
On 1.15 and 1.20, after the word weight and before the word of, insert rating.
Rating. Yes. So it should be GVWR, which is gross vehicle weight rating, yes.
Yes. And on the Jungbauer oral amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Okay, members, going down to line 1.25, special mobile equipment. There was all these different items written into special mobile equipment, and what we're really trying to do is clarify that section. And this is where some of the bad players were in, that certain equipment that was designed as kind of an off-road, more of a farm-looking implement type of thing, and it's easiest for me to describe old street sweepers. They look like road graders. They had an open broom, and that was a piece of special mobile equipment. Well, now a lot of street sweepers are mounted on trucks and can get to multiple jobs every day. And some of the bad players, not only they don't have license plates, but they're running off-road fuel and they're driving to multiple jobs every day. And I have a street sweeper in the audience. I'm not trying to, you know, point out and say, that guy's bad or this guy's. So it's just, there's a lot of good business people out there, and we're always updating statutes for the bad players, no matter what we're doing in terms of statute. So I'm not intended to say a group of people or anything. I'm using that as an example. Same thing has happened in cement pumping equipment. Some companies have been licensing their vehicles. Some haven't. Some that are not licensing them are running off-road untaxed fuel, and they're driving on the same highways. And so we're trying to clarify all that, members, so we can get license plates, so they're subject to inspection, so they're subject to running taxable fuel. And I do have another amendment here that kind of deals with the cost of license plates on these vehicles, and we'll get to that in a minute. But we originally had well drilling equipment under or crossed out in here. We put it back in under special mobile equipment, members, because if it's a pump hoist and other water well drilling equipment registered and licensed under Chapter 1031, I'm told by the industry that if they're registered and licensed, the health department actually licenses the units and that they're subject to all other requirements under DOT regulations and stuff. And public safety didn't really have a problem with putting them back in here, and not since they are paying for some type of a license today and some have some regulation that we do keep that exemption for them under special mobile equipment. All right, then we're going to move over to line 2.10, and I do have somebody here that knows more about this, but spotter.
Mr. Chair.
Oops.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jungbauer, I'm sure as you're learning as you do this cleanup or whatever you're proposing in the special mobile equipment, you run into a fair amount of industries that have a particular purpose, and for these exemptions that are being stricken. I just also wanted to tell you that as some of us have been around here for a while, you will run into legislators who actually carried part of these stricken words. Mm-hmm. So you might have to address that as we move along.
And I think Senator Scoy, Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy will have some things that do address that. But the main thing is, again, trying to capture some of the bad players, if you will. And I think underlying 2.3, it's in another place where it talks about machinery that has been temporarily or permanently mounted on a commercial motor vehicle chassis. That's why some of the abuses came in, where some of the equipment could be mounted to a truck and where you might have to pull it or put it on a tractor trailer to haul it to a job. You might only be able to do one job. and so you were very limited on the amount of time, or you know, driving an old-fashioned street sweeper to a job, you couldn't get much accomplished. But now, in terms of some of the equipment that's mounted on a standard truck chassis, they can do just as many jobs in a day as I can do if I have my pickup loaded with my construction equipment and I'm going to do repairs. So putting the same amount of miles on, they ought to be subject to a tax for a license to use the highways, like everyone else. If you can make the argument, part of the exemption will be probably in my amendment. All right.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Jungbauer, I have made the argument once in my legislative career, and so I'll look forward to making it again.
All right. Fair enough. Let's go through the bill, and you can make your argument after I do the other amendment, hopefully.
Well, let's go to spotter trucks.
Spotter trucks. There's been some new legislation in terms of spotter trucks, and we're trying to give them an exemption.
Senator Jungbauer, first we'll just instruct Council to correct the spelling on line 10 on page 2. We don't need an amendment for that. We'll just make sure that the spelling gets
I could use a little help explaining what's going on with spotter trucks and what we're trying to accomplish there, because I'm not altogether sure that we handle it the way I was understanding it. So,
Mr. Estenson.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Jeremy Estenson, and I work for the Minnesota Trucking Association. And the reason this is before you, and I don't want to speak too much on behalf of Driver and Vehicle Services, Mr. Olilla can fill us in if there's something that I miss, but essentially what a spotter truck is a single-passenger, single-axle vehicle with a hydraulic fifth wheel that you might use in a commercial operation where you have a large dock facility, a large warehouse facility, many docks. And this vehicle is for someone to drive around in and essentially stage the trailers, get them ready for the drivers to go, et cetera. And these vehicles actually come in two types, manufacturer's certificate of origin that says for on-road use, and that vehicle has a EPA mandated engine. It essentially meets all the requirements that any other commercial truck must meet, and there is a not for on-road use type, and that vehicle is essentially needs to be updated to meet DOT safety requirements. It does not necessarily have the EPA exhaust system and whatnot. The change, the reason for this is that for at least 20 years, potentially longer, DVS has been issuing license plates to these vehicles marked not for on-road use, which actually violates, I believe, U.S. DOT regulations. And essentially what happened is that DVS, in looking at their own rules, found that they should not have been doing that, and then really without notice corrected their mistake and started not issuing these things, these licenses to these vehicles. And at $80,000 a pop, we had a few members who were upset, and therefore we're looking for a solution that doesn't compromise safety over a short period of time, allows them to depreciate out these vehicles. And as an association, our job, and we've already started, is to educate these folks so that if you drive them in a uncontrolled parking lot or ever touch a public road, you have to follow, or excuse me, in the future, you have to buy a for on-road use vehicle and purchase license plates, I believe starting in 2013. So like I said, we're just looking for a temporary solution to fix this problem and hopefully try to save a few trucking companies out there some headaches.
And that 2013, the exemption that expires on June 30th, 2013, that's on line 5.5.
It may be worth pointing out that we specifically are requiring that drivers of these vehicles have CDLs and that they must comply with all of the safety regulations that DOT has.
All right, thank you.
Okay, that's the spotter truck section then. I'm going to move to line 6.8 on the page 6. Complete streets.
Senator Jungbauer, what happened to...
Did I miss something?
Section 5.
Section 5.
Yeah, it's back on page 2. Unless this is it's a difference.
No, that's just something on the section 5 under 168.28 is still penalties on the registration, if not it is ever used to transport persons or
okay,
property.
Okay, that's just, all right, that's more of the previous chapter.
More goes on to there.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay, 6.8, Section 13, Complete Streets. It's a study by the Commissioner of Transportation with Met Council, representatives, counties, statutory, home rule, and charter cities, towns, to study the benefits, feasibility, and costs of adopting a complete streets policy. I have a testifier on exactly what a complete street is. He's working at the federal level on complete street legislation at the federal level, and Gary Schoquist is best to be able to give you a quick highlight of what a complete streets.
Mr. Schoquist.
Chairman Murphy, committee members, my name is Gary Schoquist. I work for Quality Bicycle Products in Bloomington and at the national level for Bikes Belong. I'll just make three quick points about complete street policies. They're being adopted around the country because they make sense. We have many states and many large urban areas who have already adopted complete streets. We've been here a long time. I won't bore you with the list, but we do have a list. Number two, it's also a national movement endorsed by a wide variety of organizations, everything from AARP, planning organizations, transportation associations, landscape architects, transportation engineers. Many, many different organizations are endorsing a complete streets policy. Streets that are not complete virtually require people to drive cars for short distances. 50% of all trips in urban areas are less than 3 miles in length. 28% are less than 1 mile in length, yet virtually all of these trips are made by cars. In many Minnesota communities, and many of your constituents would agree with this, you can see where you want to go. You can only get there in a car. And with childhood obesity and sedentary lifestyles an issue, a very simple policy that would encourage people to walk or bicycle when they can to get to these places only makes sense. In summary, complete streets makes economic sense. It improves the safety. Vehicle crashes are declined. It encourages more bicycling and walking in areas where that's applicable. It eases transportation congestion, and it's good for air quality in our Minnesota communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the testifier? Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Jungbauer and Mr. Schoquist. This is what I was trying to get at earlier, I think, and I don't know if you were here when I raised the question, Senator Dibble's bill. Although, as I look back at Senator Dibble's bill, I wonder how your advisory committee interacts with this if it's if both of these become law, because it seems to me there's some synergy there that is worth exploring. And so I think this is a great idea, and at least on this part of the bill, I'd love to be a co-author, Senator Jungbauer. Not sure about the rest yet, but I have heard from my one of the city council members that takes particular interest in Bloomington about the need for us to do this, and I know that he's excited about that. And so thank you for bringing it forward, and hopefully we can move that forward this year.
And, Mr. Chair, members, that kind of plays into the health care reform bill in Article 1 under public health and being able to make available grants to cities to actually create walkable and bicyclable communities. If we have this study done to know how to implement it, it would go a great deal of distance towards cities being able to plan some of this. Mm-hmm. I'm not an advocate that you should do it everywhere. I think that would be really dumb and really costly. Mm-hmm. But I look forward to the day that I can ride my bicycle to the Capitol without, you know, getting killed and such like that. So,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think one way.
Everyone's flipping out on me. Jeez.
Senator Day, I thought you were going to say that you were looking forward to the day when you could ride from Owatonna.
I would like to see him ride his bicycle from East Bethel. I'd like to follow him.
Well, Senator Day,
if he comes, let me know. I'll come out of retirement.
If you're willing to follow me with a flashing light, as long as I can wear some bright colors, I'd be happier than heck to ride my bike down here.
Senator Day, and I can guarantee you that Senator Jungbauer might be breaking some speed limits on his bicycle, too, because he likes to kind of go for it. Anyway, Senator Larson,
thank you,
back
Mr.
to
Chair.
The bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, I think as people are thinking about this, and Senator Dibble is familiar with this project, but I think for us to envision the challenge that cities face, there's a provision in Senator Langseth's bill that would provide for renovation and repair of this old Cedar Avenue Bridge, which is an important project in Bloomington, crossing the Minnesota River. And the Senator, in fact, I think Senator Carlson is the author in the Senate. And we also have the desire to create accessibility on the north end of the Cedar Corridor to the Minneapolis
network of bike opportunities, and it's the in-between that's the challenge, and I think that's where this can help us to solve that challenge, because we're going to no doubt have many portions of that corridor that are going to have to be on street, and it's not an insignificant problem, as I'm finding out, for us to solve. So that's just an example of how this works together as we're starting to bring forward a proposal future legislative sessions on the Theater Corridor, and hoping we can get that link this year in the bonding bill. But that's an example.
And Mr. Chair,
sounds like a pitch to Senator Langseth.
For Senator Day, I can, I don't have one of those big corporate retirements that I can fall back on, so I can actually ride my bicycle down here for about a 39-cent donut, and that's enough power, when gas is $4 or $5.
Mr. Chairman, Youngmar, what you should do is the guys that I ride the light rail with.
Here we go.
They live downtown, and they put their bikes on the light rail and they ride out the Minnehaha, and then they go ride their bikes, and then they put it back on, and then they ride back downtown. So what you could do in later life, you wouldn't have to have a car. You could get by light rail and get your bike, and live close. And get your exercise. And
well, Senator Day, in my case, it'll be the North Star Corridor. The North Star Corridor. I can just put my bike on the North Star and ride it right down.
There you go.
It's one of those things. And Senator, just so you understand, I did, in order to try to get some grassroots support for this, I invited the press last fall, and I ran across my district 21 miles, and then I got on my bike and rode it back. So I can make the distance. But no newspaper showed up, so I didn't get a whole lot of. If I would have died, I think they would have showed up. But
I even wrote them a press release, and they still didn't show up. So
to beautiful East Bethel, I wanted to show them the ability of our roads to be able to swallow up a bicycle without even thinking twice.
Yeah.
Well, we will move on. I'm going to offer my amendment to this. The reason I kept it separate, members, is so that we could discuss it separate and not get it kind of mixed in there. Oh, Senator Dibble has a question first.
Senator Dibble.
Yeah. Just on the complete streets, which I think is a great idea, too. I had kind of a false run at this my first year in the legislature. I had a concept called the community preservation routes, and it was this, but then a little bit some, too. I mean, we were looking beyond the curbs as well, looking at, and it was crafted to kind of mirror the natural preservation routes that we have already in statute, letting you vary some of the geometric standards for roads to recognize the setting that they're built in. And it was triggered by this gargantuan expansion of a CASA road right through our neighborhood that was really, really destructive and inappropriate. So I think it's a great idea, and actually would like to talk to you a little bit more. We have talked a little bit about it, but talk to you more about kind of what goes on beyond the curb as well.
Right.
I would also reflecting on Senator Rest and what she would focus on, and she would probably focus on how exactly lines 624 through 627 are constructed. And before this, you probably want to. She has the guidelines for how we develop who gets reported to and when reports are made and that sort of thing. She would say something like report to the ranking.
Yes.
A minority and majority members of the committees that have jurisdiction over blah de blah. And then she wouldn't probably like the December 5th, 2008, she'd probably like January 15th, 2009 deadline.
Well, in fact, Senator Dibble, I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to put it out actually to December 5th, 2009, I think, in order to do this properly. And in discussing this with MnDOT, they would love to give it proper consideration.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to make that amendment to my amendment to put it 2009 instead of 2008. But in working out the details for possible inclusion, I'm sure Senator Rest can help me out with the ranking minority member and all that, although I think in this case the current ranking minority member would be pretty close to following this and where it might go.
Might be on board.
Right.
And then Senator Jungbauer, and folks, just so everybody knows, we're gonna mark this bill up a little bit, and it's going to remain in the committee until we get all the wrinkles ironed out of it, and then we'll put it in the omnibus bill. I think that would be a good place for it.
That is my intention, Senator Murphy. Because one of the other things, and we will discuss it with this amendment to my delete all, I want to make sure that we clarify things that need to be excluded yet or covered under special mobile equipment. Mm-hmm. Things I can think of are conveyors for moving rock and sand pits and things. We really need to clarify that. When you're pulling something like that, we don't want them to be licensed. We don't want them to have to be inspected just for an incidental pull down the road or rock crushers and things like that. And mm-hmm. industry saying they're afraid that we've deleted too many things, and we want to make sure that those are.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Well, we're going to make sure they have some time to think it
over. And Senator Scoy, too, to make sure he has time to give me his intention of the original.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, I was going to help Senator Jungbauer as he searched for examples, and one of them would have been the truck log loaders. Those are the ones that I particularly care about.
Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that we didn't inadvertently. The idea was not to leave the statute so old that we're still including things that have been changed, but I may have inadvertently executed things that I shouldn't have, and we want to fix that before we do anything.
Yeah. Senator Jungbauer, this is...
this amendment deals with things that were exempted before under special mobile equipment, mm-hmm. and realizing that they should have a license in order to especially get rid of the bad players that run off-road fuel and stuff. But if it's the intention really comes in that if it is used only to provide a service and is not able to haul goods for resale, and let's see, did I have, I must not have the newest version of that. Because we want, oh, no, here it is, yes. Underline 1.12, the mounted apparatus must perform an off-road or off-payment function. So meaning, again, members, they're driving down the road. They need to pay some, like the rest of us, for use on the road. They should be running taxable fuel. But like a concrete pumper, as an example, other equipment that literally drives to the job and then performs its other function off-road or off the pavement, we believe should only pay a small percentage of what a normal vehicle that's making its living on the road hauling goods or people. I didn't put a percentage in here because I thought that was really the issue that we needed to discuss. Industry came to me saying they thought 15%. I wasn't sure that that was necessarily a good number, so I really wanted the input of the committee on how we felt about that, what kind of miles they were mm-hmm. putting on. And we have some industry people here that could testify as to what they think in terms of their miles they're operating.
Mm-hmm. Senator Jungbauer, let's do this. on your A4 amendment on line one, about three-quarters of the way over there, it says SCS3545A-1.
Yep.
That one is supposed to be a 3.
Yes.
And then along with this motion, we'll also correct the date that you wanted on line page 6, line 27. Mm-hmm. Change that from 2008 to 2009.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Dibble was right that mm-hmm. Likely there's going to be a desire to make that January 15th, 2010.
Mm-hmm. Okay. January 15th, 2010. Mm-hmm. All right, on the A4 amendment, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Now, Senator Jungbauer, let's do this. Let's take some of the testimony from some of the folks that came to talk about this a little bit, and then what we're going to do is we're going to hold the bill over, and you're going to get with some of these folks and make sure that all of our I's are dotted here. Look at him fighting to the bat rack. You'd think I was back pitching again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Rick Johnson with Tiller Corporation. Tiller Corporation is a holding company for Barton Sand and Gravel and its subsidiaries. I'm here to talk a little bit about the special mobile equipment and some of the verbiage that's been put in there that really affects what Senator Jungbauer was talking about with the rock crushers and, mm-hmm. and conveyors. And I think the real intent of when this statue was probably originally made was for that type of equipment and perhaps not the truck-mounted equipment. So that verbiage is something that we are opposed to. In the past, that particular statute talked about special mobile equipment means every vehicle not designed or used primarily for the transportation of persons or property. And when it talks about the self-propelled, it completely takes us out of the loop. We have, I think there's two different types of special mobile equipment. One is towed or towable equipment, which would be something that you pull behind a tractor that already has a license and is paying a fee. And then you have the self-propelled equipment, which would be a truck-mounted unit, something that you're driving down the road. And I think with this in there, the self-propelled really is just some verbiage that could perhaps need to be changed. One of the other things in there that I see that may be some language that is already in some of the special mobile equipment. It's in 423. It talks about special mobile equipment and the speeds where you operate. Some of the special mobile equipment now that operates out on the road is oversized equipment, and there are certain standards that you have to meet in regards to escorts, in regards to speed, and I think it would be a bit redundant to change some of those to something greater of what this is as well. Thank you.
So, Mr. Johnson, are you talking
oversized with escorts?
Exactly. So you would be talking about like one of Dawes' great big cranes. Is that the kind of equipment you were talking about?
Actually, Senator Murphy, it could be. You know, it depends upon the size of the equipment that there is. I mean, we are restricted to size and weights based on the vehicle length, the vehicle width, the vehicle height, and its weight. And dependent on the size of it would oftentimes the operator or user of that vehicle would be required to obtain some type of permit, either it be from the city, from the county, or from the state to transport that vehicle. And depending upon the size of those vehicles would determine what level of speed that you could operate at or if it'd be required to have some type of an escort.
Okay.
And all hours, right, of operation as well.
And hours of operation.
Mm-hmm. Well, make sure you continue to work with Senator Jungbauer here. He's always trying to he's trying to do the right thing here. And
thank you.
He's worked in the industry, a certain part of that industry for quite a while and mm-hmm. has some personal experience in that regard. So, Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd like to ask, because I've been sitting here listening for quite a while, I guess what I'd like to ask is Senator Jungbauer, how, is there a major problem or where did you come up with the different whatever, and I mean, I know that there's been one night, I think I was watching one of these kind of I gotcha 5 o'clock news sweeps or whatever that had some people that were sweeping out apartment complexes, and then they went down the road to the next complex and did some sweeping or whatever, but where did you come up with all the different ideas of things that are out there moving around? And if we did get some kind of fees out of them, what are we talking about, or what? I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Day.
I missed a lot here, but I've been sitting here and I've been trying to wonder. Okay, what? I'm kind of a little bit in the dark. What you're really trying to do, or what's the problem?
Well,
Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Day, over the last several years, it's been a number of things. Meeting with DVS, Department of Public Safety, some of the issues on accidents and things within my district and the ability to issue citations based on whether or not vehicles or towed apparatus is licensable, is subject to inspections. So working with the department and vehicle services and constituents in my district, and then other business owners that would come in and complain and say, wait a minute, so-and-so is running off-road fuel, and, you know, we're trying to run a clean operation here. And so I'm not trying to beat up on people, but I'm trying to make sure that the statutes are evenly applied. And I'm kind of nuts, you know, some nights I just sit in my office when I have time between meetings and read the statutes and say, well, you know, this is kind of outdated. We ought to update the existing statutes, and we ought not to create all kinds of new laws if we can just update stuff that's already on the books. So it was a combination of all those things in trying to update and clarify the statutes mostly that brought me to this.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl.
I just want to respond. Senator Day, I think your bewilderment with Senator Jungbauer is shared by many of us. But we love him anyway.
Well, Senator Dahl, if I can bewilder and, you know, cause people to be in a quandary, then I'm probably doing my job, because I somehow just don't like creating all kinds of new statutes when I can just update old things and make it work for the realities of today.
Okay. Is there thank you, Mr. Johnson. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify? Please come to the table.
Mr. Chairman.
Can we have your names for the record, please?
My name is Roger Renner. I'm a groundwater contractor in Elk River, Minnesota. I represent the water well industry as a past president of the Minnesota Water Well Association. Dave Schellenberg is the current director. I come to you on behalf of the water well industry with regards to this bill and how it will affect us.
Let's stop a second. In the delete all amendment. Kept you in there because as long as you're licensed under Chapter 1031.
It's 103I.
Okay. 103I?
Yes.
Okay. 103I, as long as you're licensed under there, you're not affected by this bill.
There's two spots in there that we are actually put back in there.
Okay.
So we need to work out
put
the
back in there, okay.
As to what's that. Maybe that's where we need to come from, but at least to give you some background on what the industry has.
Okay.
We were first licensed in 1974 by the Department of Health by statute. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, we had no licensing. We were considered actually implements of husbandry. Absolutely no license plates, nothing at all. Also in 1974, our pump workover rigs were also required to be licensed by the Department of Health, simply because we were working on the groundwater, and they wanted to have a license for the contractors that were out there at that time. Mm-hmm. We fall under 103I. Special mobile equipment, we're the only people who are required to be licensed under special mobile equipment. Mm-hmm. I checked with the Minnesota Department of Health yesterday as vice chair of the licensing board there. In 2007, Minnesota had 640 drill rigs and 515 pump installing rigs. They were able to provide the Department of Health $86,625. Now, officially, they can't come here and be concerned about their program, but as vice chair and in my 24th year as being on the advisory council, they are concerned. With the decline in the housing industry and fewer wells being drilled, almost down to 60% of what it was 2 years ago, there's a lowering amount of revenue for the Minnesota Department of Health. Taking away this licensing requirement by them would certainly affect their program. A small percentage of our drilling rigs are mounted on trailers. And if you look on the drawing and the pictures that are provided to you in the handouts, you'll see some of those rigs and pump trucks and rigs that are actually towed by a licensed vehicle. So those are semis. All of our pump and service drilling rigs are still subject to the same Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration requirements and regulations, including annual inspections, just like all DOT-plated vehicles. I'd like to have you also refer to a single-page handout, which is Minnesota Laws 2001, which shows, in fact, that we are required to have this requirement of an annual inspection. We pull into the weigh scales, and they go through the same inspections with our rigs and our pump trucks, whether they got a license on them or not. And for the most part, we provide this little blue document to most of the state highway patrol haven't noticed that we don't have a license plate on our rigs. Our license is on the side of the machine. So from time to time, we do get pulled over, and a few minutes, we're gone because we provide them the laws. Mm-hmm. The Minnesota Department of Transportation, for the most part, has adopted the federal motor carrier safety rules and regulations. And most drillers who are behind these rigs are required to have a commercial driver's license. Some require tanker and hazardous endorsements. We're still licensed, but, again, we're not with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. We are required for all of these inspections. A hardship here of having double licenses for the same piece of equipment would be a hardship not only for ourselves as drillers but for our customers. Under the term special mobile equipment, our drilling and pump service rigs have a federal flavor to them also, as they are affected by federal highway use tax. Fuel to use on these well rigs, since most of the time, most of the fuel burned in these rigs are for drilling wells or servicing them. So consequently, the Minnesota Department of Transportation or Revenue in 2001 granted us the ability to measure our road miles, and we pay road tax on those. We put road tax fuel in our rigs, and at the end of the month or at the end of the quarter, depending on how much road we use, we apply for a rebate back on the road tax and pay the sales tax, and that's how we were able to get around it. So we're not the bad guys. We're kind of the good guys in this here. The change in the term special mobile equipment is a federal term and is defined by every self-propelled vehicle not designed to be used. There's several spots within this Bill 3545 that it's been put in and it's been taken back out. And actually, there's in two spots, it was actually taken back out. Senators showed that it was put back in 1.29, and it appears as though it was, again, just stricken back out on page 3 and 3.20. And actually, in 3.28, special mobile equipment does not include machinery that's been temporarily mounted on commercial vehicles and chassis and dump trucks. Well, that's exactly what our equipment is. So there's kind of some language here that we'll have to work out with them. In essence, we're following all of the rules that are required. If left in as special mobile equipment, we won't be able to go 30 miles an hour or higher. We may need to have a spotter, a truck that helps us bring it down to the job site. So we're rather concerned about having that kind of language. We would freeze our well industry. We wouldn't be able to take it out on the road. It'd be too dangerous to run it 30 miles an hour down the road. We're willing to work with the senator to be able to work out, but in essence, we need to fall back under the auspices of the Minnesota Department of Health as licensed. We are required to have insurance on our equipment. We have auto insurance on our rigs. The rigs, the equipment that's on these vehicles are under our equipment floater, so we're fully insured. And for those of us that have hazardous endorsements, we're required also to have a $5 million umbrella, which is extremely high, simply because of what we're hauling. So it's fuel for some parts and explosives in others. So we're concerned. In one essence, we want to be part of the special mobile equipment, but with the restrictions that are within it, I'm afraid we're going to have our hands tied and won't be able to move. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. We're willing to help with the language.
Yeah, Mr. Renner, and I know that Senator Jungbauer, he wants to make this work for everyone here. And, by the way, I don't want those Johnson boys down there in Red Wing coming and visit me about this. So.
Yeah. Johnny Johnson.
We didn't, looking at that, I wasn't thinking that. That was designed to be around something else. But we'll get square. I guess we didn't... Spierzowski and I did not notice again that it was in 3.20, Mr. Chair. And we will certainly get all that straightened out, and I can see the heartburn under Section 9 for a lot of these things. It was some things we were working on with public safety and specific rigs, and I think more of a definition of what should be operational under that as opposed to a general blanket would cover that. So,
all right.
Good points.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Renner, Mr.
Schulenberg.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Especially when they're from my district, I better be paying special attention.
Yeah, you better, especially when he's the president of the association.
Yes.
I'd have to come out and fix his well one of these days.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify? Please.
My
My name is Mike MacDonald, and I'm the general manager for Crosstown Sweeping Corporation. The sweeping vehicles that we use are greatly affected by this piece of legislation. I have talked to Senator Jungbauer, and he was glad that I came and met with him and that so I can be able to help him iron out some of these issues that he's got. I do know who the bad guys are. And I have a good understanding of what he's after here. Mm-hmm. Because there's different types of street sweepers, we tractor-trailer most of our street sweepers around because it's just for sweeping. It's a self-propelled vehicle, and same thing you see the highway department here using. We're on over-width permits whenever we move them. I work closely with Captain Ken. I guess he's gone now. In assuring them that our even trailers are specialized made just to haul those sweepers. We do have another sweeper that's a four-wheel configuration that is mounted on a Ford truck chassis. This is capable of highway speeds. So we could take this machine down the highway, get to our job, sweep that job, and then move on to the next one. Most of the material that we pick up at that particular job site is left on site, so we're not traveling with a full hopper. Although the machine is designed to do so, we don't feel it's a safe condition to operate it in. Additionally, there are mobile air sweepers, which are vacuum litter machines. They, too, are a unit that's mounted on a truck chassis, usually a one-ton truck chassis, that currently are not required to be licensed. That's the current legislation, and that was repealed a couple of years ago. Prior to that, it was. The broom-type sweeper that I've got that is truck-mounted is not required to be licensed. We do have a DOT sticker put on it because I need that truck chassis and the entire unit, as far as the company is concerned, in proper working condition. So even though we're not required by law to put a DOT sticker on that, we make sure that it has DOT certification before we put that on the highway. That's just something that we do. It's not required by law. For the greater percentage of the people that I know in this industry, and I've been in it since 1975, go out of their way to make sure that they're compliant. We've been involved in illegal dumping situations where we've been falsely accused. The industry has not had the best reputation in the past. And for the few of us out here that are trying to make that difference, it's a little bit odd. I can tell you that one of my competitors who does a state fair every single year, that would be a job situation where he's on city streets and state streets, but probably wouldn't be required to pay taxable fuel under the law as it sits right now. What we do is simple, is the same that was just done by the gentleman up here before me, is that we put taxable fuel in all of our equipment. And it's easy for us to identify at the time that we're filling this equipment what's going into a sweeper and what's going into a tractor trailer. We keep track of that difference, and we apply for a fuel tax refund on an annual basis. And we've had no problems with that. And then we're not, and we've had our fuel tanks sticked by inspectors when we're on job sites just to make sure that we're not running off-road fuel. Although those sweepers are always off-road. But it doesn't pay for us logistically to go out of our way to have bulk fuel delivered, to handle it, and to put up with all that nonsense. It's an easier way for us to do it is to just pay it and then apply for the tax fuel refund. Mm-hmm. So I understand what the senator is after here. And I think that he's correct, and we're not quite sure that this is the apparatus to do that. And I'm more than willing to sit with him and figure some of this out. But I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you guys have.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
I think Senator Jungbauer, we had this discussion last year about the pumpers and stuff.
That went real well, didn't it?
but I do think there is a new kind of class of vehicles that are, you know, I mean, I was following one of these pumpers, or he was catching up to me, and I was running 70, and he was catching up to me. So, I mean, they're really built for moving on the highways. So I was kind of surprised when you said that your Ford-mounted sweeper wasn't licensed.
It's not required because it's considered a street sweeper. And that's its only function. It can't do anything but sweep streets. It can't haul material around. It can't. It doesn't haul passengers. It's got dual steering in it. So you really don't want a passenger in it because both steering wheels turn at the same time, work through the same hydraulic system, and it'd be unsafe if you had a passenger that happened to play with that steering wheel on one side when you're trying to operate it with the steering wheel on the other. So these are very specialized pieces of equipment. And to try and isolate that in language, I can understand the problems that are coming into here. None of our equipment is at all like the well drilling equipment. It's completely different. But we do share similarities in the use and the operation of it and how it's transported on public highways. So that's where the similarities are, and then that's where they end.
Senator Olstein, just for future reference, when you're in committee and you say you're going 70 out on the highway, make sure that when the state patrol's in the audience that you say I-35 north of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I don't know if the guy that was coming up behind you had much of an excuse, but. thank you, Mr. McDonald. And Mr. McDonald, make sure you keep working with Senator Jungbauer here. I think that, we all want the same thing. We want, everybody to pay the appropriate amount of tax, and we don't like trying to, lump people who are trying to do the right thing like yourself in with, the bad actors, as Senator Jungbauer has called some of those folks. So.
Well, we're a very small company. I didn't even realize that this legislation existed until I got a phone call from a welding drilling company this morning informing me that street sweepers were listed, which I thank him for. I sent the majority of the people in this body an email today letting them know that I was opposed to it and I was willing to work with this group in any way, shape, or form that I can for an appropriate clarification. We only employ 10 people. But this is all we do is sweep. We push some snow around in the winter on a limited basis, but the crux of our business is street sweeping. And the majority of it is done on a subcontracted basis by all kinds of construction industry. But thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Is there any further discussion? If not, we're going to lay this bill on the table and let Senator Jungbauer continue to work on it. And whenever you feel the bill's ready to go, Senator Jungbauer will push forward. Senator Carlson.
I have one question, Senator Jungbauer, that has been bugging me since we passed the description on there. It's Section 9, Special Mobile Equipment. And we're talking about driving it. No person may drive special mobile equipment within the meaning and at speeds greater than 30 miles an hour. We talked about that. And then without an escort vehicle, is this the sum total of safety equipment that has to be on a vehicle that is only going 30 miles an hour? Do we require the slow-moving vehicle signage? Do we require flashing lights? Does it need any kind of permitting or any kind of anything to make sure that a 30-mile-an-hour vehicle might not get rear-ended?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I wish Captain Ken was here because that was actually their idea, and they had specific type of mobile equipment in mind that, in their opinion, was designed not to operate at speeds in excess of 30 miles an hour, and they thought that it needed to be included under the same type of a speed limit and possibly slow-moving vehicle signs and issues like that, such as tractors. So I wish he was here to give me some more there, because my inclination without an explanation would be we could easily take Section 9 out, but we can work on that as to why they were trying to get that, because I can see that to be very troublesome in a lot of these other issues. And at this point, I'm not especially moved by Section 9 unless I can find a better clarification about what their ideas were in including that.
Why don't you circle back with Captain Urquhart and make sure that we get that Section 9 cleaned up there a little bit. It looks like that was given
the most scrutiny.
More than one testifier a little bit of heartburn. So
yes.
With that, Senator Jungbauer moves to lay Senate File 3545 on the table. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail, and the committee is adjourned. Thank you. Yes.